Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241, and it is September 24th. It's the day after your first lecture exam. Let's take a look at the schedule real quick. So last Tuesday, the 22nd, indeed, we had our first exam. And, I was here for that, but I wasn't here for that lecture right before then. All right, so today we're going to get into enzymes and energy. That's chapter 4. We may or may not finish that today. Not too sure. Hopefully close to being finished. When is your next exam? Yeah, it's the 20th. It's going to be on chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9. 4, 5, 7, and 9. And it is going to be on a Tuesday. So that is 3.5 weeks away from today to give you a sense of how you have to plan. Okay, so what do you use to prepare for a lecture exam? Study guide, yeah, make sure you work those problems so you understand, you work with the information, and you can't memorize the answers to the questions because there's just way too many questions, right? You got to get a good sense, a good feel for what's going on. Okay, anybody have a question about the schedule? We're doing pretty good with that. All right, some comments about the test. I do have them graded. They're in Blackboard. I don't think anybody has seen their test, but you all have to come by my office hours sometime and take a look at the exam because there are a lot of students that thought that they did much worse, but they did pretty good, and then I have students that think they did much better and didn't do so good. And so you got to figure out why you have that feeling that's not accurate. Come by and look at the questions and, of course, make sure that the Scantron is graded properly as well. And that information is good to know. So if you review it again on the test, right, that's just, you'll just learn it a little bit better going forward in the class. Even though this is not a cumulative testing class, you still have to bring knowledge forward to the next exam with you. Okay, so I have office hours Tuesday, Thursday in the morning. And maybe right after lecture, I can show people some tests for a little bit, so you don't have to be here early in the morning on Tuesday or Thursday. And the other comment I have is that I threw out one question on the test, but haven't credited anybody's exam yet, so the score in Blackboard, you can probably add 2 points to it, right? Because every question is worth 2 points, right? So. So to figure out your percent right, divide the score in Blackboard by 2. And that would be the percentage. So I need to add 1 percentage point to everybody's exam, which turns into 2 points in Blackboard. So come by and I'll show you how I'm going to calculate that. Had a good question. Was it regarding the test or was it a end of chapter question? No, it was a test, right? Your question? Yeah, it was on the... It had to do with sodium and potassium. Too bad I don't have the question with me. It was, can you describe the electrochemical gradient for sodium, right? For sodium, I think that was basically it, right? Not for potassium, but for sodium. So let's see if I can do this really nicely. All right, so we got a cell, right? There's a nice cell, and we're interested in sodium. And you should just automatically know, where's sodium at a high concentration? Everybody know? You got to say it out loud. Yeah, everybody's got to say it. Sodium is high outside the cell, right? You just got to know that. And that means it's low inside the cell. Remember, there are some molecules that are super big that are trapped inside the cell. They can't leave and they have a negative charge on them. What can you tell me? What is the relationship between this positive charge and negative charge? Do they repel each other or attract? Yeah, they attract each other. Okay, so we just want to keep it like that for now. So here we have a lot of sodium outside the cell. I like this. And so some more sodium over here, because you told me there's high sodium outside the cell, low on the inside. Maybe I'll just put one in here. Like so. All right, and so there are two forces. There is electrical attraction and chemical gradient. And how do these things balance each other out, or do they work together or against each other? And this is for sodium, not for potassium. All right, so as far as the chemical gradient, we have high sodium outside, low inside. Which way will sodium want to move? Just passively, by diffusion. Yeah, it will want to move inside. All right, so the chemical is inwardly directed. Does everybody kind of see that? Things are just going to move from high concentration to low concentration. All right, but we also know, right, that these negative charges inside the cell make the inside of the cell negative. So what about the chemical attraction? Is it going to expel sodium, or is it going to try to bring sodium into the cell? Because I only see this one little plus charge here, a lot of negative charges. So what does sodium want to do? It wants to go in as well, right? So the electrical gradient is what? Inwardly directed. All right, so both inwardly directed because of the chemical and the electrical charge. And in a normal cell, sodium can't get across the membrane. It's dying to get in there to neutralize those electrical charges, to neutralize the concentration gradient across the membrane, but it can't get across the membrane, and you should have a good sense why that is. Why can't sodium go across the membrane? Because sodium is a polar compound, and the inner part of the membrane is nonpolar, and so polar compounds cannot get through the membrane unless there is a special protein or channel put in the membrane. And sometimes those channels can be opened and sometimes they can be closed. So here is a protein. Here's a protein in the membrane, and right now it's closed. Sodium can't get in. Let's open it up all of a sudden. All right, so now we have this pore or channel so sodium can move across the membrane. What is sodium going to do in this particular case? Since now it has a pathway to get across the membrane, what is sodium going to do? And you have to realize it for two reasons, electrical and one for chemical. What's going to happen to sodium? Is it going to stay the same on either side of the membrane? Is sodium going to leave or sodium going to go in? Okay, look at the concentration gradient. Passively, how do things go? High concentration to low concentration. So due to the chemical gradient, sodium is going to want to go in, right? There's that arrow right there. What about the electrical gradient? Sodium is still going to want to go in, right, due to this, due to the electrical property. So as soon as this channel opens up, guess what happens to sodium? It rushes inside the cell because there's an electrical gradient and chemical gradient pulling it inside the cell. And remember, sodium has a positive charge, so then when sodium enters the cell, what happens to the membrane voltage? Remember, in the cell, at rest, it's negative. As sodium rushes in, what happens to all these negative charges? They disappear, right? Because they're neutralized by this charge for sodium. So the membrane is what we say depolarizes when that happens. You didn't have to know anything about depolarization, but at rest, you should see that sodium is dying to get inside the cell due to the electrical gradient and chemical gradient, and as soon as there's a pathway available, what does it do? It rushes inside the cell, and then it changes the electrical property of the cell. Okay, and you know what? That electrical property is like changing the structure of this cell. And when you change the structure of something, what do? Change the function. That's right. So when these electrical charges do something that changes the function of that particular cell. So what I wanted to show you were these two forces, electrical gradient and chemical gradient. That was a pretty nice question on the test. Anybody get that one right? That's nice. If you saw that, it was really good. I'm sure that was a question someplace online. I'm not sure. And that's wonderful. Okay. So let's start with today's lecture. Okay, enzymes and energy. And that looks pretty good. I'll turn some lights off in just a second. Visible, nice. All right, so we're going to have to learn what an enzyme is and what energy is today. So let's start by thinking about what an enzyme is. Some people might know what an enzyme is. And a good place to start to know what an enzyme is to understand what a chemical reaction is. All right, so I'm going to erase this nice cell right here. So what is a chemical reaction? Chemical reaction is when we have something we call reactants and we're going to put a couple reactants here, A plus B, right? And these things are going to turn into something else, which we call products. And so we don't want to put A and B over here, we want to put some other kind of letter. Could be A prime, B prime, but C and D probably even work a little bit better. Okay, C and D. I got carried away. Products, reactants, because there's two of them. All right, so this is a chemical reaction. Sometimes this reaction is slow, right, and it takes a long time to produce C and D. Sometimes this reaction is really fast, and C and D are produced almost instantaneously. And in this reaction, reactants are always going to be turned into products because I see a one-way arrow right there. Okay, so that is chemical reaction. And if this was an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, then these reactants right here would have another name. They would be called substrates. Okay, so what's another name for a substrate? It is a reactant in some kind of chemical reaction. Yeah, that's a reactant. So, when we think of an enzyme, we just call it a substrate instead. And probably you'll see why that is in a little bit. Okay. All right, so let's look at some of the slides from this particular chapter, but we're going to refer to that diagram a couple times. All right, so here, enzymes. They're biological catalysts. All right, well, you know something about biological molecules. Can anybody give me a class of biological molecules? Proteins. Ah, that's good. That's one. Protein, sugars, lipids, nucleic acids. These are biological compounds. All right, so enzymes could be sugars. They could be proteins. They could be nucleic acids. From what we understand right at the moment, right? And catalyst, what the heck is a catalyst? A catalyst is something that will speed up the rate of this reaction. So without a catalyst, it might take hundreds of years for this reaction to produce any kind of measurable product like C and D. But if we put an enzyme in with this, or a catalyst in with this particular reaction, then C and D will form instantaneously. Right, so the rate of that chemical reaction speeds up with a catalyst. So a catalyst increases the rate of a chemical reaction, and most catalysts or enzymes in our body are proteins. There's a couple examples where they're nucleic acid, but they're almost always proteins. What's the building block of a protein once again? Amino acids, that's right. And how does an enzyme work? All right, it works by lowering the activation energy required for this reaction to proceed. All right, so let's take a look at this graph to understand some of these concepts. Well, when we look at a graph, what's the first thing we got to do? We got to look at the axes to know what we're thinking about. So let's look at the axes. All right, this top row, we're looking at the number of reactant molecules. Right, so as we go up in this direction, there's more and more reactants. And on the horizontal, we have the energy of those reactants. Right, and notice that all of these reactants don't have the same energy. Right, if they were the same energy, then this would just be a straight line going up. But there's a distribution. Right, so it means that at a very low energy level, way over here, there's just a few reactant molecules. Right? And on the other hand, if we go way out over here and measure the energy of these reactant molecules, there are some, very few, but there are some that have very high energy. Right? And then most of them have like this intermediate energy. And this energy refers to, when we talk about molecules, it just refers to molecular motion. For instance, when you have a molecule, it just doesn't sit there. Say like a book on a table, but it's moving around, it's vibrating, it's stretching, Okay, it's jostling around all over the place. So as the energy increases for that molecule, that motion gets faster and maybe more exaggerated. So that's what we mean by energy of a reactant molecule. The first column here shows us what happens for an uncatalyzed reaction. Right? And there's no enzyme, there's no catalyst. And here the bottom graph, we have energy plotted along a time axis. Right? So here is energy versus time, and we're looking at reactants. Right? And what do reactants turn into if there's a chemical reaction? They turn into products, right? Okay, and active energy should be considered as a barrier that prevents this reaction from taking place. Okay, so if we have reactants at high energy and the products at low energy, what do these reactants automatically like to do? Do they like to roll downhill or roll uphill? Yeah, they like to roll downhill. Right, so if the reactants have more energy than the products, then this reaction will take place. It has a tendency to take place, but there can be a barrier that prevents or slows that reaction down, and that's symbolized by this little wall. That's the activation energy. Right, and that's important because that adjusts the rate or changes the rate of a chemical reaction. But when we put activation energy in, right, to get this ball up so that it can get over the activation energy, what do you get back out of the chemical reaction? The same amount of energy that you put in, right? So the activation energy you put in, you get back, so it cancels out. It just allows this reaction to take place. And then what is the energy released in this reaction? It's signified by this gold arrow, yellow arrow. What color is that? Gold, yellow, something like that. Okay, so the energy that's released is just the difference in energy between reactants and products, right, because this activation energy cancels out. All right, well, let's look at the next column. Number of reactant molecules versus energy. And with this column over here, we have put in an enzyme or a catalyst that will speed up the rate of a reaction. And so what's one way that we could think about speeding up the rate of a reaction? Okay, we didn't change the temperature or anything, right? So the energy distribution is exactly the same. It's just when we put in a catalyst, then we have more reactants that have sufficient energy to get over the activation energy barrier. Right? That's the only thing we've changed. Just more molecules have that proper electrical, proper motion and speed of motion to produce a reaction. So if we were going to diagram it, like over here, again, we have a plot of energy versus the catalyzed reaction. The only thing that changes is this barrier, the activation energy that is slowing down the reaction. So with a catalyst, right, we still have reactants. And what are the reactants in the catalyzed reaction compared to the non-catalyzed? Do they have the same energy? Same level, right? Reactants have the same energy, okay? But what can you tell me about the barrier right here? Is it the same height or lower?
Lower.
That just means that the activation energy is lower, right? It's easier to lift this ball up over this little wall, and then we let go of it, and it's going to roll downhill. So what can you tell me about the energy of the products for the catalyzed versus uncatalyzed reaction? Is it the same or different? You should see that it is the same, right? It's right at the same energy level. And what about the activation energy? Do you get that back like before? You put activation energy in to get over the barrier, starts to roll downhill, you get that activation energy back. Okay, just like the first case over here. All right, so if we look at what to me looks like a blue arrow and a yellow arrow, And the blue arrow represents activation energy. Do you see a difference between the non-catalyzed and the catalyzed reaction? Which one is, how would you describe the second one here? Indeed, it is a smaller, right? So it requires less activation energy. Okay, now what about energy released from this chemical reaction? Look at this. The yellow arrow is still the same height, whether it's catalyzed or not catalyzed. So the only thing that changes is the amount of activation energy that's required to get the reaction to take place. So enzymes don't change, okay, the energy that's released, right? It just reduces the activation energy. So over here on the left, we have reactant molecules, right? Maybe you need to spell the rest of that out. But if it's an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, maybe you should cross that word out, right? Cross reactant out. And what would you like to label this molecule right here? If it's an enzyme, it's a substrate. That's probably not a bad thing to do. All right, so the take-home message here is that when it is an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, the activation energy is reduced, but the overall energy that is released is exactly the same, right? Because when you put in activation energy, you just get it back. Okay, it doesn't participate in the reaction. That's what I wanted to show you on this particular slide. Okay, mechanism of enzyme action. Well, we said enzymes can speed up the rate of a chemical reaction by lowering the energy required, okay, for that reaction to take place. And that's due to the structure of the reactants and the structure of the enzyme. So enzymes have a particular shape, have a three-dimensional shape. We call that conformation. And how would you describe that three-dimensional shape in terms of the protein structure that we first looked at? Yeah, it's a tertiary structure, right? Because primary determines the secondary. Secondary structure determines the overall shape of that molecule. So it's the tertiary shape. And these enzymes have certain pockets on the surface, and we call these active sites, in which these substrates or reactants fit. We don't want to use reactants now. We want to use substrates because it's an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. And so it just so happens that these enzymes work by bringing substrates together in just the right way so that they can react. And a pretty good way that I think of that, how is this possible? Okay, another kind of example. Here I have a couple markers, and we want to end up with a molecule that's blue-red, right? And it's going to, so here are the substrates. We put them together to form a product. The product is blue-red in a nice straight line, a nice linear line. Without an enzyme, these things, these substrates are going to be moving around randomly all over the place, right? And if we heat them up, they'll move faster, right? But they always have some kind of molecular motion. When they bump into each other like this, the chemical reaction can't take place. It can only take place if they bump into each other like that. So how many ways can these two markers bump into each other where there's no chemical reaction taking place because they don't bump into each other just the right way? Probably millions of different combinations of ways these molecules can bump into each other, and when they bump into each other like this or like that, the reaction won't take place. But if we put an enzyme in with these substrates, the enzyme will take these two substrates and put them together in exactly the right way so that you end up with blue-red in a nice linear shape like that. And so when that happens, then these molecules don't have to just bump into each other randomly. The enzyme, like, assembles that molecule because of the shape. Okay? So that's one way that I think about reducing the activation energy. It just brings the substrates together in just the right way so that a reaction can take place. Anybody have a question with that? All right, let's go on to the next slide. So here we have an enzyme, and we have a couple substrates. You should think of these substrates as what, being reactants, for instance. We got substrate A, substrate B. Right, so we got A plus B going to C plus D, and here's an enzyme. And what is the what's the rate of this reaction going to be? Really, really slow or fast? It's fast because there's an enzyme there. So how does this work? Here's the enzyme, and here are some pockets in the surface of the enzyme. Remember, we call those active sites. And they have just the perfect shape so that substrate A can fit into this active site, substrate B into this one, right? And so as a matter of fact, B won't fit into the active site for A because it has the wrong shape, right? So A has to be over here, and B has to be over here, and no other combination. So when substrate A and B bind to the enzyme, we get something special. We get something called the enzyme-substrate complex. And when the enzyme-substrate complex forms, look at how substrate A and B now bump into each other. Just in this one particular way. And this particular way allows for that chemical reaction to take place. And after they bump into each other, right, then they are released from the active sites and you have two different compounds, and you can see now D has a part of what was on substrate A. So the chemical reaction took place. All right, so A and B substrate turned into C and D substrate if there's something special that forms. What was the special thing that formed in order for this chemical reaction to take place as catalyzed by this enzyme right here? There's something that has to form, right? Before substrate A and B can be converted into product C and D, there has to be something that forms before that happens. And it is right smack here in the middle. It is called the enzyme-substrate complex. So if the enzyme-substrate complex can't form, guess what happens to this chemical reaction? It does not proceed rapidly, right? So that's going to be an interesting concept for you. Right, if we say something about enzyme-substrate complex, if it doesn't form, then you know that the rate of that chemical reaction is going to slow down. That's a necessary step. All right, so what do we call this molecule where I have the cursor hovering over right now? What is that? Is that enzyme-substrate complex? No. Is it substrate? No. Is it product? No. What is it? You give your last choice. That's an enzyme. Right? So here's an enzyme. And here it is over here. What's the difference in color between these enzymes before and after the reaction? No change. What about the shape? No change. Right? And so that's a really important clue. And that just says that the enzyme does not change when the chemical reaction takes place. Right? So the only thing that changes is substrate is converted into product. And look at these active sites. They're exactly the same. So now this enzyme can catalyze that reaction over again. It can bind another A and B, put them together just in the right way so the chemical reacts so that the enzyme substrate complex forms that produces more products. Right? And guess what? Then the enzyme can do that job over again and over again and over again. And that's another reason why the rate of that reaction speeds up, because the enzyme does not get used up. And that's a characteristic of any kind of catalyst. A catalyst is never used up in the chemical reaction, and an enzyme is just a biological catalyst, mostly made out of proteins. Okay, so that's pretty good. Just remember, if it's an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, what would you want to put here instead of reactants? Substrate, yeah. So kind of a minor point, but that might be important at some point in time, just so that you can make the connection right here. All right. And the enzyme does not get used up. Something that your book doesn't really point out, which is really important, without a enzyme present, and let's take a look at these two markers once again. Two markers, blue, red. What kind of molecule did we want? Blue and red together just like that, nice linear sequence, okay? Without an enzyme, we saw that these markers could bump into each other in all kinds of different ways, not producing this nice linear blue-red. Sometimes when blue and red bump into each other, right, they actually form another compound. They get stuck together like this. And this compound is what we call a side reaction. The side reaction could be really dangerous in our bodies. So what's another beautiful thing with an enzyme? It prevents side reactions from taking place so that the only reaction that happens is the one that your body wants, right? So it's very efficient. It has a high yield. That's something else that's really nice about enzymes, and that's why industrial processes are trying to use enzymes all the time, because they have almost 100% efficiency. Okay, when somebody wants to make a product, that could be perfume or any other kind of thing. All right, how do we name enzymes? The modern nomenclature is that enzymes end in an A-S-E. The suffix is A-S-E, and
We have some enzymes are named according to their activity. Sometimes they're named by their substrates. Right, so a phosphatase is an enzyme that removes a phosphate group. You remember what a phosphate group looks like? Inorganic phosphate. It's a PO4 compound. Okay, and something that's a kinase is something that's going to remove a phosphate group. And we have phosphatases and kinases in our body working all the time. One removing and the other adding phosphate group to molecules inside of our cells. Now, how does that strike you? If you have enzymes, right, one that removes and one that adds, they're kind of working against each other. What can you tell me about that? They're antagonistic to each other. And is that really a stupid, silly thing to have in a control system, or is that a very good thing? It's a very good thing because it provides for precise control and balance of that particular activity. Right? And you know some nice musculoskeletal examples of antagonism that provide for really nice, precise control and balance of your body. Right? So, for instance, tomorrow night, you're driving home after happy hour, you get pulled over, and the person with the really fancy blue uniform and the badge and the sidearm says, please step outside the car and take your index finger and put it on the tip of your nose, like that. All right, so they're doing a sobriety check. So if you're intoxicated, you can't do that with your eyes closed. All right, and so why, if you're not intoxicated, why can you put your fingertip right on your nose like that? Due to antagonistic control of what? Biceps brachii, triceps brachii. All right, so these two antagonistic enzymes work through that same principle. Right, there is an important nervous system that has two divisions that are antagonistic to each other. You know, what are those nervous systems called? They take care of your body without your conscious thought. Sympathetic is one, and parasympathetic is the other. And I think in anatomy, you learned at least a little bit that they are antagonistic to each other. For instance, one will speed up the heart, the other will slow it down. And that's not a bad thing, that's a great thing, because then you have precise control and balance over your heart, which is perfect. And give me an example in your automobile of two mechanisms that are antagonistic to each other, but you would never dream of driving your automobile without these two antagonistic mechanisms. Your gas pedal and your brake pedal, right? So these things are really great when you have a control system that you need to have precise control of. Okay. You ever drive a car that didn't have brakes but a nice gas pedal? That's really scary, I must admit. Okay, good thing I'm still here. Okay, so some enzymes, right, may specify the substrate. Like if the substrate is a lipid, then we take that name lipid and we put an ASD on the end of it, and it's called a lipase, right? Or if it's a enzyme that breaks down a protein, it's a protease. So those are just different ways. If it's an enzyme that removes hydrogen atoms from a substrate, like lactic acid, we call that a dehydrogenase. Could you tell me that a dehydrogenase is an enzyme? And why? Because there's an ASD on the end of it, right? And this particular one also tells you what the substrate is. It is lactate. And what it does, it removes a hydrogen. Okay, so that's naming. Here's a table, and that has. Can you tell that all of these are enzymes right here? Because there's an ASC. Probably one of the more important ones that we're going to be looking at here is carbonic anhydrase. And carbonic anhydrase takes water and carbon dioxide. And do you have water inside your body? Lots. You have carbon dioxide inside your body? Yes, lots, right? So these are important biological compounds. They're not organic, but they are important biological compounds. Carbonic anhydrase can take these two molecules and make carbonic acid out of it. And you'll see why that is so important, right? And if there's carbonic anhydrase in your body, what can you tell me about this reaction? Is it fast or is it slow? It's very fast. If you have this enzyme. So we'll look at an application for this numerous times in the class, maybe not today. Catalase is something like hydrogen peroxide, that you have in your medicine cabinet, hydrogen catalyst. Oh no, sorry. Catalase is an enzyme that can take hydrogen peroxide. Here's the chemical form of hydrogen peroxide, H2O2. Sometimes your body produces this compound, and it's kind of a dangerous compound to have around in the body. It's very reactive, so your body would like to get rid of it. And here's the enzyme that gets rid of it. It's called catalase. Different forms might be called peroxidase, and it can take H2O2 and convert it into water and oxygen. And so you have a bunch of this in a medicine bottle at home, hydrogen peroxide. Does anybody have hydrogen peroxide at home? Or maybe you think you do, probably a bunch of people. Raise your hand really fast. Hydrogen peroxide, oh, lots of people. Okay, good. All right, so what kind of bottle is it in? A brown bottle, and it is opaque to light. Light can't get in there because light is energy, right? So hydrogen peroxide will just automatically break down into H2O and oxygen. And if you keep it in that bottle and don't shine light on it, it can exist in there for thousands of years, right? And however, if you take that hydrogen peroxide and put it on some tissue that you've damaged that has released catalase, then this reaction will proceed how? Very rapidly, almost instantaneously, right? And it produces oxygen. That's what produces those bubbles when you put it on a cut, right? And it also produces water. And that's really nice for a cut because this water irrigates the wound, right? That washes out bacteria and all that other kind of stuff. And the bubbles produce, right, due to oxygen, and that oxygen is very toxic to many forms of bacteria. So that's why hydrogen peroxide is fantastic. Okay, ribonuclease. This is a compound that works on RNA, and it requires water, and it produces ribonucleotides. Right? And so what kind of chemical reaction is taking place here? I see a water. You have a big, huge polymer, RNA, and water producing smaller molecules. That is a hydrolysis reaction that you're familiar with, right? So here is an enzyme that does that very rapidly. You might say, oh, I don't know if that's a really good thing to have, but you know what? There are restriction enzymes inside our cells that prevent DNA or RNA from other organisms from infecting our cells. And so we have enzymes that will just run around and break those nucleic acids down before they can harm our cells. All right, so what is enzyme activity? Well, it is the rate that substrates are converted into products. Right? And if that happens fast, there is high enzyme activity. If it takes thousands of years, right, then the rate is low, or the enzyme activity is very low or slow. It's just the rate of substrates into products. But remember, that's the same thing as what? Reactants going into products. And what determines whether an enzyme will catalyze a reaction? Okay. It is the shape of the enzyme. And if the shape of the enzyme and substrates are just right, what is something that can form? The enzyme-substrate complex, right? And then the substrates are put together just in the right way to put the exact product that your body wants. Okay, the shape of this protein right here, because we said most enzymes are proteins, can be changed with temperature, can be changed with salt concentration, can be changed with pH. And temperature, because that changes the molecular motion, the vibration, the stretching of this molecule, and that might change the shape of the enzyme. So here are a couple enzymes. If we measure enzyme activity on the vertical versus temperature, what can you tell me about this particular enzyme as we increase the temperature? 37 is pretty close to body temperature. What happens if we increase temperature of this particular enzyme, not the person that it's in, but just this enzyme, what happens to enzyme activity? Yeah, you see as you go up on the horizontal scale, the activity increases, so as you increase temperature, the enzyme becomes more efficient, right? The rate increases, and it kind of levels out after a while, but now here's kind of the startling thing. What happens above 40 degrees centigrade? What happens to enzyme activity? It starts to go down, right? And it will eventually go to zero. And how would you explain that? Why is this reaction slowing down or even stopping? Because the enzyme substrate complex, right, is being changed so that it cannot form. And it doesn't happen like a snap of a finger, but it changes gradually. Okay. The other thing that we notice right here, that if we're operating on this ascending limb, if we increase the temperature from 10 to 30, we increase the rate of the reaction, but then if we change the temperature once again from 30 to 10, right, what happens to the rate of the reaction? It goes down, it slows down, and then if we increase the temperature again, it speeds up, right? So that's a reversible process. That is reversible, right? So the rate just determines on the temperature and nothing strange happens. But if we go above 40 degrees and really decrease the rate of the reaction when we get to 100 degrees, what happens to the rate of the reaction when we go from 100 back to 37? All right, so we're going to move back this way. How would you draw a line of enzyme activity, right, going back down from 100? You know what? It wouldn't go back up. It would be a nice straight line. Okay. So what happens above 40 degrees is something that we call denaturation. We've increased the temperature so much, we've increased the temperature so much and made this molecule twist and bend and vibrate so radically that it can never go back to its what we call native conformation. It has lost its particular shape forever. Okay, and that's an irreversible process, right? Denaturation is reversible. I mean, denaturation is irreversible. It's a catastrophic event. That's one way to think about it. All right, and you're really familiar with this process, actually. All right, so let's presume we have some proteins here, like a hamburger, right? And you know what raw hamburger looks like. And not too many people like to eat raw hamburger. What do you like to do? Cook it, right? And as we increase the temperature, especially up past 40 degrees, what happens to all those proteins inside that hamburger that you made? They denature, they change their shape, the consistency of that hamburger changes, right? So it's a lot easier to eat. And that was just done with temperature. All right, so you're about ready to sit down and eat your hamburger, and then you get a phone call from your friend saying, hey, we got three people here at a pool table. We need a fourth person really bad to shoot some pool. And will you come down and join us? And so what are you going to say? No, I got to eat a hamburger? Well, for sure not. You would say yes? Okay, well, I probably would say, no, I tell you, okay, I'll come down. And so what am I going to do with that hamburger that's cooked, ready to go? Put it in the refrigerator, right? Put it in the refrigerator. The temperature goes back down, but does that cooked hamburger look like a raw hamburger just because you cooled it down? No. Why is that? Because those proteins have been denatured, right? So not only does temperature change activity of an enzyme, but there are other things like pH and salt concentration. Because that changes what? The pH changes the shape of the protein, which then alters the formation of the enzyme substrate complex, which then alters the rate of that chemical reaction. So here are three enzymes that have an optimal activity, right? This is just a plot of enzyme activity versus pH. Pepsin has an optimal activity, maybe around 2, maybe a little bit less than 2, depending on how you read this graph right here. And then as we increase the pH, right, the activity goes down. This is a protease that works in your stomach. And that's why the pH of your stomach is extremely low, because that's the optimal pH for the initial digestion of proteins. Salivary amylase. Amylase, I didn't point this out, but amylase is an enzyme that breaks down complex sugars into simpler sugars. And where do you have saliva? Where do you have saliva? Where is it produced? It's produced in your mouth, right? It's produced in your mouth. And do you think you have a really radical pH in saliva or your mouth? Is your mouth very acidic? Is it very basic or is it kind of neutral? It should be kind of neutral, right? Okay, and it just so happens that salivary amylase has an optimal pH of what? Neutrality. And that's where it has its most activity. And then when you swallow something, what happens to salivary amylase? It's busy digesting complex sugars down in your mouth, but you swallow it. What happens to its activity once it gets into the stomach? It's destroyed, right? Because look at its activity. At pH 2, it is non-existent. All right, so salivary amylase is not so important for us, typically, because how long do you chew food for? Like a minute or 2 minutes or 5 minutes when you're chewing something? Okay. Seconds, probably, right? So this enzyme is not so important in humans, but other animals it is. Trypsin is another protease, and it operates at a really high pH, like 9, and this is an enzyme that breaks proteins down in the small intestine, and that's why you know that the pH in the small intestine is really high, really opposite compared to the pH in your stomach. All right, so you have initial digestion and a final digestion of proteins. So proteins are actually kind of hard to digest or break down via hydrolysis reactions. Okay, here is just a list of some enzymes with their optimal pHs, and by looking at their optimal pH, you could probably tell me where they exist in the body. All right, here are some definitions that I want to go over. And these definitions work perfectly for this class. They might not work very well for other classes or other disciplines, right? But this is how I want you to operate in this class. These two things are called cofactors, or they are called coenzymes. All right, these are necessary for normal activity of enzymes, but there's a difference, right? Because they're different names. A cofactor is just a small metal ion, right? And it has a charge. Most of these have a +2 charge. A cofactor is just a very, very small particle that's a divalent cation. And you can see some examples, right? You know all of these, copper, calcium, magnesium. You need all of these things in your body for certain enzymatic activity. As opposed to a coenzyme is a very large organic molecule. Very big, and it's organic, so there are carbon with hydrogen bonds associated with it. Are these cofactors organic compounds? No, they're not, right? They're just they're not even a compound. It's just an inorganic ion. All right, so coenzymes are huge. Cofactors are small. Coenzymes are organic molecules, right? Cofactors are just elements, metal elements. So there's a really big difference. Some coenzymes are derived from vitamins, and a vitamin is just a particular kind of organic compound that our body can't make. We have to have it in our diet. And if it's not in our diet, then a particular set of chemical reactions can't take place, because coenzymes will transport a molecule from one set of chemical reactions to another. It carries something from one metabolic pathway to another metabolic pathway. It's carrying something around. That's what a coenzyme does. Okay. So here I see a slide, right, and I see an enzyme, and I see some substrates, and this is a nice proper enzyme because the substrates can fit into these little pockets. What do we call these pockets once again? Active sites, that's right. But these substrates can fit in this active site only under certain circumstances. So here is a cofactor, and is this large or small? Molecule, small metal ion, right? And sometimes this cofactor has to bind to the enzyme at a site other than the active site, and that changes, nonetheless, that still changes the shape of the active site, so now that substrates can fit into it, and then what happens? Enzyme-substrate complex can form, right? If this cofactor binds to the enzyme. If the cofactor can't bind to the enzyme, then the active sites don't have the proper shape to allow for the enzyme-substrate complex to form, and the rate of the chemical reaction is going to slow down, right? So that cofactor is important. We call this allosteric regulation. Okay, if this little regulatory molecule binds to an enzyme at a site other than the active site, we call that allosteric regulation. So you can imagine that some enzymatic reactions in your body are regulated by releasing cofactors or hiding cofactors within the cell. Now, what is the difference between what's happening in this bottom row right here? A little bit different enzyme,
substrates kind of look the same. And here's a cofactor, right? But what's different in this bottom row? And it's changing the shape of, yes, changing the shape of the active site, but you know what? It changed the shape of the active site in the top row too. Okay, check out where the cofactor is binding. Here's the cofactor. It binds to a site that is part of the active site. Okay, and so you can have two possible cases. This little activator can bind outside of the active site, can bind within. Right, and then the enzyme has the proper shape so that the enzyme substrate complex can form, and then the reaction will proceed. Right, so this is what we call allosteric regulation if it's outside the active site, and it's orthostatic if it's inside the active site. Allosteric versus orthostatic. And the slide doesn't show you that very well, but you should probably know something about that. Enzyme activation. Many enzymes are produced in an inactive form, and I think that should be really obvious. Like the pancreas produces a number of digestive enzymes, for instance, like trypsin, which will break proteins down. And if the pancreas produced an active form of trypsin, then trypsin would digest the pancreas, right? And that would not be good. That happens when you have pancreatic cancer, right, or pancreatitis. Really dangerous kinds of things, right? So the pancreas produces inactive forms of that enzyme. They're transported via the main pancreatic duct into the small intestine, and in the small intestine they become activated, and that's where they do their job properly. Right? So some enzymes are activated in just the right place where they should have activity, and they're kept in an inactive form in a place where we don't want them activated. So they can be activated by phosphorylation and inactivated by dephosphorylation. What is an enzyme that phosphorylates something? There's an enzyme that phosphorylates something. We went over the definition, but this is all new stuff for you guys. And in a couple of weeks, this will be like ingrained in your memory. An enzyme that phosphorylates something is called a kinase. Okay, the kinase. Did I mention that previously, just a couple minutes ago? Kinase? I think I did. A kinase will phosphorylate something. All right. And what is the enzyme that can dephosphorylate something? That's a phosphatase, right? So kinase and phosphatase are antagonistic to each other. And sometimes when a molecule is phosphorylated, it becomes activated. Sometimes when it's phosphorylated, it becomes inactivated. But the only other thing you have to remember is that the opposite then is true as well, right? So it can act like a switch to turn an enzyme on or turn an enzyme off, and it's regulated by either a kinase or a phosphorylase. Other enzymes can be activated by really small molecules that we call ligands, and these ligands sometimes build up inside the cell. We call these second messengers. All right, so we're not going to look at this for a little while, but I don't want you to forget about this. That's pretty important, right? That ligands, right, can be second messengers, and they can regulate enzyme activity, mostly by binding to the enzyme. All right, I got another graph to look at. The effect of substrate concentration on the rate of a chemical reaction. So here we have a really nice plot of reaction rate versus the concentration of substrate. So as we increase the concentration of reactants or substrates, what can you tell me about the reaction? Does it stay the same, decrease, or increase? It increases, right? So here's a nice increase. But now as we increase the substrate concentration, what can you tell me about the rate of change, okay, when we add substrate? It starts to slow down. And eventually it gets to a place where even when we add more substrate to this mixture, right, the reaction does not increase. Right? We call that saturation. So enzymes can be saturated. Right? So let's go back to looking at this slide right here. Okay, so here are the substrates. What can you tell me about the rate of this reaction if there are no substrates? Let's erase these things. Okay? Then there's no enzyme substrate complex form, right? And there's no products form. So that's kind of a long way of saying that nothing is going to happen. All right, let's put in a little bit of substrate A and B. right? Some enzyme substrate complex is going to form, so we get some products, and that's a pretty fast process. So if we start to add more and more of this substrate, then more and more product is going to form. But we get to a certain point where the enzyme is all bound up. All of the enzyme is in the enzyme substrate complex right here, because there's enough substrate A and B so that all of the enzyme is in this complex form. So if all the enzyme is in this middle form right here, what happens to the rate if we add more substrate A and B? Well, that extra A and B that we added have no place to go on the enzyme because it's already occupied by some other substrates, right? And when we add substrate and we don't get more enzyme substrate complex form because the active site is already bound up, we call that, what do we call that? Saturation. Nice. Okay. All right, so that can happen. There are some reversible reactions in our body. Reversible reactions are due to the fact that the sum of the energy of the reactants is equal to the sum of the energy of the products. And this reaction can go to the right and can go back to the left, because here you see an arrow and it's a double-ended arrow. This reaction can go either way without input of energy. And this is, in particular, a really good reaction to know. It's really important in our body. This reaction does go backwards and forwards. And so you would probably like to know what controls, which way does this reaction go? And the reaction is controlled by the concentration of the substrates or the concentration of the products. And it's governed by what we call the law of mass action. Some people in chemistry might know this by a different name, Le Chatelier's principle, or you could say, Le Chatelier, I wanted to hear it like in a Russian accent, but that's okay. Okay, Le Chatelier's principle, law of mass action. What does that say? Here's that chemical reaction. If we add water over here on the left, that's going to force the reaction to go to the right. If we add carbon dioxide on the left, guess what happens? It forces the reaction to the right as well, right? And if we add both water and carbon dioxide on the left, that forces the reaction to the right, okay? However, if we add carbonic acid to this solution, what's going to happen now? It's going to force the reaction the opposite direction, right? It's going to force the reaction to the left. All right, so I think that's pretty easy to see. What's not easy to see, and you should be really familiar with this, if we take carbon dioxide away, if we take carbon dioxide out, which way is going to be favored? Going to the right or going to the left? Okay. If we take carbon dioxide out, this reaction is going to have a tendency to put it back. So the reaction is going to be forced to the left, right? If we put a compound in, it's going to force it to the other side. If we take the compound out, it's going to force it to be replenished. That is the law of mass action, or the Chatelier's principle. And you told me already that you have a lot of water in your body, a lot of CO2 in your body, and there's a really important specific enzyme that can make carbonic acid out of that, and you just got to know the name of that enzyme. What's the name of that enzyme? Enzyme means it speeds up the rate of this reaction, so it's fast, okay, and it's called carbonic anhydrase. And you saw that on a previous slide. But that's one probably you should just start memorizing, okay? Even this chemical reaction right here. Because we all know our body produces a lot of CO2. Okay. Metabolic pathways, right? A metabolic pathway is when we have a bunch of steps of chemical reactions, or maybe what we call a sequence of chemical reactions taking place. And they're catalyzed by enzymes. So if they're catalyzed by enzymes, what are we going to call reactants once again? They're substrates, right? So here is a metabolic pathway. We start with initial substrate A, and it has the right shape to bind to enzyme number 1, right? So the enzyme number 1 substrate complex forms that produces a product that we call B. And it just so happens that B has the right shape to become the substrate for a different enzyme, enzyme number 2. And B binds to enzyme number 2, the enzyme substrate complex forms that produces a second product. And that second product has the right shape to bind to another enzyme, which produces, right, another product. And then this D product has the right shape to bind to enzyme number 4,
which produces, right, even a fourth product. Right, so here we see A has been converted to E by a number of these steps. B, C, and D, E are what we call intermediates. It's not the final form, it's not the final product that your body needs, because E has the right shape to bind to a fifth different kind of enzyme, and that will convert it into F. And that's the final product. So when we have a metabolic pathway, A can be converted into F, right? But we have some of these intermediate steps, right, that produce these intermediate compounds that we just call intermediates. Right? So a biochemical pathway or metabolic pathway can have a number of different steps where different intermediates are produced. And they are bind to an enzyme based on shape. They all have to have the proper shape. So A, initial substrate A, cannot bind to E to produce F because the active site of E doesn't match up to the shape of substrate A, right? So you need this series of steps in order for that to happen. There's something called end product inhibition. Well, I tell you what, let me go back to this slide. So here we have a nice metabolic pathway. A is being converted into F. And if we just look at this particular metabolic pathway right here, okay, and we let it run, we're going to see that all A is converted into F, right? So F is going to build up inside the cell, and it's going to build up some more, and it's just going to build up. But inside your body, you just need a particular concentration of F. You don't want it to increase and increase and increase and increase. So there is something called end product inhibition, so that when the proper level of F is reached, then it shuts down that particular metabolic pathway. So here is a kind of metabolic pathway that is operating, right? So we got A converting into B, and then finally C. And then at C, okay, this is a substrate. It has the right shape. It can bind to two different kinds of enzymes, right? Enzyme 3 or enzyme 3 prime. It has the same affinity. So this is what we call a branch point. And if C binds to enzyme 3 prime, it gets converted into these, like D prime and E prime, because they're different enzymes. What do we call D prime and E prime in this metabolic pathway, this lower metabolic pathway? D and E, these are intermediates, right, in this lower biochemical pathway. And then finally, E prime is converted into F prime. And what controls the activity of this bottom pathway? It's the concentration of that final product. When it reaches a sufficient concentration, it can feed back and bind to a spot on enzyme number 3, and when it does, it changes the shape of enzyme number 3, so C no longer is attracted to it. It can't bind to it. And that basically what shuts down this whole lower pathway right here. Right? And so we call that, if it binds to the enzyme, okay, if F prime binds to the enzyme, what kind of inhibition are we going to call that? If it binds to the enzyme, it's allosteric, right? And or you could call it orthosteric, depending on whether it binds to the active site or some other place on the enzyme. All right. And then when enzyme 3 prime is inhibited, then the top pathway can take over and produce a different kind of product, which is F. All right. So where does end product inhibition usually operate inside of a cell? At this branch point right here. Right. It doesn't operate in the middle of a metabolic pathway, because then things would just back up. But it operates at a branch point. Nice. Okay, that's end product inhibition. Bioenergetics. This is cool. When do we end class here? 12:45. Maybe we can talk about some of this. All right, this is sometimes really hard to understand, right? But we have to understand what energy is, right? It refers to the flow of energy anywhere, but we're interested in living systems. Okay, but somebody has to tell me, what is energy? What the heck is energy? It's a real thing. Energy gives you the ability to do work. That's probably the best way to think about energy. So when you have a lot of energy, what can you do? A lot of work. If you have low energy, you cannot do a lot of work. Okay, so that is probably a really good place to start to understand what energy is. There are two laws that are really important that describe how energy flows. The first law states that energy can be transformed from one form to another, but it can't be created or destroyed. So what are some forms of energy that we work with day in and day out? Temperature, yeah, heat is a form of energy. As a matter of fact, temperature of a compound is really the purest measure of energy because the temperature relates to the motion of that molecule. As we increase the temperature, the motion changes, right? And that really is what energy in its really basic form is. Okay, what about light? Is light energy? And as a matter of fact, it is. And light has different amounts of energy depending on what color it is, right? So energy scales with the color. Not all colors have the same energy. As a matter of fact, they are all different. And can, what's another form of energy doing work? How about your car? Does your car use energy? Yeah. What kind of energy does your car use? Okay, it uses mechanical energy to get you from point A to point B, okay, but how does that mechanical energy get inside your car? You don't pour mechanical energy into your car. What do you pour into your car? Gasoline. And what kind of energy is gasoline? That is what we call chemical energy, right? So in chemical bonds, there's energy. You pour that into your car. There's a mechanism inside your car that can take that energy, convert it into mechanical energy so that you can move from one place to another. You go uphill if you want to, right? So that's called an engine. So that's converting chemical to mechanical. And I got right here a pretty good example of converting light energy into mechanical energy. This is not easy to visualize. So I have this little, what they call a radiometer, and I see some paddles inside the radiometer. Are those paddles moving right now? They're just sitting right there. All right, well, I'm going to try to convince you when I shine light on it, right, which is energy, then the paddles are going to start to move around, and that's a form of what kind of energy? That's mechanical energy, right? So here is a little system that's going to take light energy, convert it into mechanical, energy. Okay, from light energy to mechanical energy, your car does what? Chemical to mechanical. Here is light to mechanical. And turn on the light. Wow, that was almost instantaneous. I didn't do anything. Okay. So this is showing what law of thermodynamics? The first law, right? Energy can be converted from one form to another, but it can't be created or destroyed. All the energy is going to be the same on either side. Not all of the energy from this light bulb is turning these paddle wheels around. Some of it is converted to heat, right? Because it's not 100% efficient. Okay. All right, so that's the first law. Can't be created or destroyed. What in your body can take light energy and convert it into something else? What's in your body that does that? You all know this. I think I heard it. Your eyes do that, right? Your eyes take light energy and convert it into chemical, electrochemical energy inside your nervous system so that you have the perception of light. Okay. So that's an allowed process. Let's look at the second law of thermodynamics, right? It states that energy transformations increase entropy, which is the degree of disorganization in a system, right? And only free energy, which is energy in a very nice organized state, can be used to do work. So that's pretty important. The last statement right here says that systems have a tendency to go from a state of high free energy to states of lower free energy. Right? And what did we say? Did we talk about entropy? Entropy right here. All right, so free energy and entropy are pretty much opposite things. If something has a lot of entropy, it has very low free energy. If something has a lot of free energy, it is low entropy. And if it has free energy, it means that something has a lot of structure. It's highly organized. All right, so if you are you highly organized or are you just a bunch of random molecules? Highly organized, right? Okay, so what does that mean? Are you high in entropy or high in free energy just sitting there? Yeah, you're very low in entropy. You are very high in free energy. And that free energy is something that can be used to do work. And things will always go from a state of high free energy to low or entropy. Gain some entropy. All right, so here I have kind of a nice simple example. I have a bunch of molecules right here. They're just dominoes. And can you tell which one or the other has more structure to it? Is it the one on the left or the pile on the right? Pile on the left, pile on the right. Which one has more structure? The one on the left. Yeah, this building right here. All right, so this building has low entropy but high energy associated with it. This pile, this random pile, has a lot of entropy because it doesn't have a lot of organization. This one has low free energy. Which one can do work? The one with low free energy or the one with high free energy? The one with high free energy can do work, right? Because, well, that's what energy allows you to do. And which way does energy flow? Does it flow from high entropy to low entropy or low entropy to high entropy? A tendency to do it all by itself. Okay? Here is low entropy, here is high entropy. Will these dominoes sitting on the table when we come back on Tuesday, will they automatically assemble themselves to make this building? No, right? So things don't go from high entropy to low entropy automatically. What do they have a tendency to do? Low entropy to high entropy. And should I show you? Should I show you that process? No? People in the front row, I don't have helmets for you or anything, but okay. So will that happen automatically? Well, all I have to do is what? What did we do? We took high free energy, right, and converted it into a bunch of molecules with low free energy, but we've gone from what? Low entropy to a state of high entropy. So energy flows from low entropy to high entropy, and that's just how energy works. Okay, we'll have to pick those dominoes up before microbiology takes over. Okay, systems tend to go from states of high free energy, okay, to states of low free energy. And, okay, if we take this pile of dominoes that have high entropy over here, can we make a structure out of it? Can a system with high entropy go to a system of low entropy? Yes, otherwise that building never would have fallen apart. But how does it do that? You have to put energy in to get something to go from high entropy to low entropy, right? So you told me that you are highly organized, you are low entropy. What do you need to make your body really nice and organized? Because it likes to become disorganized. What do you need? You need energy to do that, right? Okay, and that's why we eat nutrient molecules. All right, think about that. But if anybody has a question right now, anybody have a question about that? Okay. All right. So continuing on with bioenergetics, don't trip on any of these dominoes, so we pick them up. Okay, here we have a plot, a graph of free energy on the vertical scale, and then we got a couple items on the horizontal scale over here. And what do we have? We have the sun, okay, and we have something I'm very jealous of. Ah, and that's why it's green? No. But here's a plant. Okay, so this plant is highly organized, right? It's a very highly organized compound. And the second law states, right, that all these living organisms require a continual input of energy, right, to maintain their structure. So where does this plant get its energy from? It gets it from the sun, right? So that's really nice. So energy, which is what kind of energy? Light energy. Yeah, it's light energy. And there are certain pigments in these plants, okay, that can absorb that energy. And when it absorbs energy, it can take a bunch of random molecules like carbon dioxide and water. All right, so this is very high entropy, low energy molecules because they're just wandering around all over the place. The plant can take them and jam them all together to make a really sophisticated, organized molecule, which we call glucose, which is what? Six of these carbons and six of these waters right here, C6H12O6. And we're going to call this glucose. Glucose has these six carbon atoms. We got some oxygen left over, and that just forms gaseous oxygen right here. So this glucose is highly ordered, right? That's like the building that we built over here. And it is going to have a tendency to fall apart all by itself. But to make that building, what was required? Like to make glucose, it requires energy. Plants can do that because they have chlorophyll. All right, so I wish I was green because then I could just sit on the beach and like drink a milkshake all day long, right? That would be great, but we can't do that. All right, so that is a way that you should think about energy. This is more apropos to our bodies, right? So we saw that a plant produces oxygen and sugar. What do? Well, we take that sugar and we harvest the energy from it. Right, so if we take a really complicated molecule like glucose and convert it back down here to these random molecules, CO2 and water, look at the free energy. It is decreasing, right? So here is low entropy, here is high entropy. Energy is going to be released. We could take a sugar molecule and burn it with a match. Maybe some of you have made creme brulee sometime, right? You can carbonize sugar with a match. But our body likes to have sugar broken down in a number of steps producing different compounds. What are these different compounds called in a really general sense? These are intermediates of this metabolic pathway, right? So if there is a reaction that releases energy, okay, we call that an exorganic reaction, if it releases energy on its way to producing products. If it requires energy, right, then we call that an endergonic reaction. So if it's exergonic, the products have less energy compared to the reactants. If it's endergonic, the reactants have less energy than the products. So if we go back to this slide over here, here we got carbon dioxide and water making glucose. Is this an endergonic or exergonic reaction? Exergonic or endergonic? Okay, this is what we call an endergonic reaction because the product has more energy than the reactants. So in this product right here, it has captured this energy from the sun. And guess what? This chemical energy can be converted into other forms of energy, right? And that's what our body does, right? It takes that highly organized molecule, disassembles it, and it's an exorganic reaction. It releases energy, and the biochemistry in our body has figured out ways, right, or evolution has figured out ways to capture that energy to run other kinds of processes in our body that require energy. These other processes would be endergonic reactions, maybe like muscle contraction. They require energy. Where does it get energy from? Nutrient molecules that we eat because they are broken down through metabolic pathways. Okay, cells require constant input of energy in the free form to make sure we don't become disorganized. We say that bucks entropy, that kind of inhibits entropy from taking place. And our bodies do that by coupling endergonic reactions with exergonic reactions. And exergonic reaction breaks down ATP. ATP has three phosphates on it. They can be broken down to smaller molecules. And when ATP is broken down, it releases energy. What kind of reaction releases energy once again? Exergonic reaction, right? ATP in our body is the universal carrier for chemical energy. Almost every kind of reaction in our body can use ATP. There are a couple that use other forms, maybe like GTP, for instance, but it's very similar. All right, so here's kind of a strange statement. Most exergonic reactions in our body make ATP. So that seems a little strange. But I tell you what, let's take a look at this previous slide. What kind of reaction is this? Glucose going to carbon dioxide and water. Is that exergonic or endergonic? That's an exergonic reaction, and what is it releasing? Energy. That energy can be used to make ATP. Right, so that's the basis of this statement right here. Most exergonic reactions in the body make ATP, as we've seen on that previous slide.
All right, so exergonic reactions. Let's take a look at this plot. Free energy on the vertical, and then we just have some items here on the horizontal scale. We have reactants being converted into products, right? And the reactants have high free energy. The products have low free energy, right? So going from high to low, what kind of reaction is that? If the products have less energy, energy has left those molecules, so it is exergonic. Okay, so here we have a bunch of biochemical reactions, and it is releasing a lot of energy. These are coupled to other reactions that are going to spin this wheel the other way. It's going to take reactants that are low energy and produce products that are high energy. And, okay, what kind of reaction is that? That is endergonic reaction. And give me a really good example of this product that's being produced by this second wheel over here. This product right here is, in our bodies, ATP. All right, so ATP is a high energy product. It's made from lower energy reactants. Right, that's an endergonic reaction. So now we have a bunch of chemical energy stored in the form of ATP. And that energy can be used by other things in our body, like to maintain nerve impulses and muscle contraction and things like that. But how did that energy get into ATP? By a exergonic reaction. Okay. Here is ATP. I see the nice structural formula. You can see the three phosphate groups, the three inorganic phosphate groups. I'm not going to ask you to remember the structure of this thing. What's really important to know is that there's three phosphates, and the bonds between these inorganic phosphate groups are what we call high energy. At least the last one and the second to the last one are high energy. These covalent bonds contain more energy than a typical kind of covalent bond. And how would you take, what's a kind of reaction that would be used in your body to take adenosine diphosphate, right, which only has two phosphates right here, and a free inorganic phosphate and make ATP out of it? That would be a dehydration synthesis reaction. That's really nice if you can see that. Okay, so water would come out and these bonds would form. But what is not shown on this particular slide, which you should draw in? There is, water, you're right, water is not in here. You could draw that in. And that just also signifies that water is an important chemical reactant in many chemical reactions in your body, not just something that your body is dissolved in, but it participates in many reactions. But you know what? There's something even more important that you should draw in here. It either goes up here or down over here. And it's really something that we've been talking about so far. Energy, that's right. Where would you want to put energy in this chemical reaction? So this is just a chemical reaction that's not drawn right to left. It's drawn up and down just for convenience. Where would you put energy? Here. Would you put it with the reactants or would you put energy with the products? Okay. Oh, I'm glad I asked. Where I would put energy, okay, I would put a plus and then energy. It would be on the top, right here, right? Adenosine diphosphate and inorganic phosphate put together plus energy on the top makes ATP. All right, well, where did that energy go? Remember, energy can't be created or destroyed. We put energy here on the top with the reactants. Where did it go? It went into the chemical bonds of this product, so it didn't get destroyed, right? So that energy now has been transferred into this ATP molecule. It's right there, and there are other things in your body that can then get that energy back out. Okay, so put energy over here. And if you go the opposite way, if you take ATP and break it down to inorganic phosphate and adenosine diphosphate, what do you get? Because you just draw it in. You just drew it in right there. You get energy out of it, right? So you should be able to tell me which one is endergonic and which one is exergonic. Right? Exergonic is when ATP produces energy, when it breaks down into ADP. Okay. Well, we're going to have to talk about oxidation reduction reactions starting next time on Tuesday. And there's only two slides left, so we're not too far behind. The sign-in sheet is going around. So please sign the sign-in sheet.
So one last question I have for you guys. The last question I have is, when we open up a channel for sodium in a cell membrane, does sodium move? Sodium, remember, sodium can't get across the plasma membrane unless there's a channel that's there. If all of a sudden we open up a channel for sodium, does it move? Yes. And you should know why. The two processes that draw it inside the cell, and you should realize that it's drawn into the cell very rapidly. And the result is going to change the electrical properties inside the cell. We call that depolarization. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so here is adenosine diphosphate and inorganic phosphate. You have to draw in another physical quantity. These are molecules, but there's something else that's physical that you have to put a plus sign here. You got it. Okay? So, and this energy comes from these exergonic reactions, these metabolic pathways that release energy, can be used here to take adenosine diphosphate and inorganic phosphate to make ATP. So then this energy ends up in ATP.
So when you have energy and ATP together, that's forming that extra body.
That's a really good question. Ask me again.
When you're adding energy to ADP, inorganic phosphate, that's going to an exergonic reaction.
Okay, so this energy that's being used to make ATP, so this reaction is endergonic because it's using up energy.
Oh, but if energy was this way, it would be exergonic.
It would be exergonic. And where does your body get this energy from to run this endergonic reaction? From all of these exergonic reactions here, all of these metabolic pathways. And that's why this statement is a little bit confusing. It says most exergonic reactions here are used in your body to make ATP, because this energy goes where? Here. So that's nice. I should have a slide that shows that, but that's nice if you can put all those slides together. That's really nice. Does that make sense a little bit now?
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of a weird concept.